September 6, 1972. All of the 11 Israeli hostages are dead, as well a German police officer and 5 of the 8 terrorists. In the files of the Munich City Police, there's a short notice that uncovers several of the official statements as false. The file signature is 1346 within the State Archive Munich.
File notice. 2 a.m. Broadcast news. IOC decided to continue the games.
2 o'clock in the morning. The bloody shootout in Munich is over for less than 2 hours. Someone in the central office of the police was listening to the radio news and he decides that it was important what he listened to. Therefore, he wrote it down and added it into the timeline of the official police diary. The radio news at 2 o'clock said the International Olympic Committee decided to continue the Olympic Games.
Geheimakte 1972. Das Olympia-Attentat in München.
Hallo Tunis, wir haben die israelische Mannschaft in unserer Gewalt.
My brother came to do sport in the Olympics and they were murdered there.
Die ganze Geschichte, investigativ recherchiert. Bisher unveröffentlichtes Material.
I was contacted by a German journalist, Christoph Lemmer.
Geheimakte 1972. Die ganze Geschichte.
Hochweg September mehr allein.
Episode 9. The show must go on.
Anki Spitzer hardly sleeps this night, the night her husband is being murdered with all of his teammates. In the middle of the night, she rings up the Israeli ambassador in the Netherlands. She asks him to send a driver and pick her up for the airport. She wants to fly to Munich and attend the grief ceremony in the Olympic Stadium that was arranged during the night for 10 a.m. After landing in Munich, she's brought to the Olympic area. She walks through the park heading for the stadium. She's surprised to see normal life as if nothing happened. Athletes do the training on the grounds at both sides of the park road. She is on a hurry. She enters the stadium just when the ceremony is about to begin. She is finding her seat between the surviving members of the Israeli delegation that were lucky not to be taken as hostages. The announcer in the stadium is an actor who is famous in Germany, named Joachim Fuchsberger, nickname Blackie. Before the ceremony, Fuchsberger wonders whether what he should say about the plannings. Will the games be ended or will they be continued? When interviewed 25 years later for the public Bavarian television, he remembers.
I was chasing after several influential people to find out what should I say during the ceremony. Will the games go on or will they be terminated? What will happen in particular? And I went from one to the other, but no one answered. Of course, Willy Daume, the head of the National Olympic Committee of Germany, was the most important for me, and he was the one to decide. Whenever I ask him, Mr. Daume, what should I say? I have to enter my booth in 10 minutes. What should I say? Are the games over, or should I say they will be continued? He replied, go up to your booth. You will receive a sheet of paper with the information. I cannot tell you more. I will never forget the look on his face when he added, Blackie, they are shooting our souls out of our bodies. We don't know what to do. Maybe the president of the IOC knows. And so I went up to my booth.
Vielleicht weiß es der IOC-Präsident. Und so ging ich rauf in meine Kabine.
Really? 50 years later, this looks even more surprising. The stadium announcer doesn't know what he shall announce just minutes before the ceremony starts. It seems as if he didn't know what was publicly revealed in the 2 o'clock radio newscast saying the games would go on. The first speech then was delivered by Willy Daume, head of Germany's National Olympic Committee. During his whole speech, he mentioned neither the heritage of the victims, Israeli, nor this of the perpetrators, Palestinians. He did not even differentiate between perpetrators and victims, and no word about the fact that, again, Jews were killed in Germany for just this one reason, because they were Jews. Let's listen into Willy Daume's speech.
Selbst in der Welt des Verbrechens.
Even in a world of crime, there are taboos, a last barrier of dehumanization to shy away from. The guilty people in the Olympic Village broke this barrier. They brought murder into this beautiful celebration of the people of the world, a celebration of peace. The hardships and dangers of earthly affairs are not always distributed according to one's own favor and expectations. But may this break through the last barriers of human civilization inspire the world to finally renounce violence, to condemn and despise it as misanthropic and an abomination, wherever and for whatever purpose it is used. We join the families, the team, the countries in their sorrow as we leave the day with its immature frenzy behind. And there is only the consolation that we do not shape our own destiny, but that our present and our future lie in a higher hand.
Sondern dass unsere Gegenwart und unsere Zukunft liegt in eines höheren Hand.
A higher hand. It sounds almost as if the terrorists were guided by God. And then the moment that Anki Spitzer never forgets.
So I went to this Gedenkfeier and then I heard the fascist, racist Avery Brundage, who was the president of the International Olympic Committee then, and he said, the games must go on.
The games must go on, and we must...
And the crowd in the stadium applauds. Somehow it felt like a collective relief. The world continues spinning, the games will go on.
File notice. On September 6, 1972, at 11:10 a.m., the following information reached SAK-3. We now are confident that 5 of the perpetrators are dead and 3 are alive. This means that the command consisted of 8 men. This is hardened through the finding of 8 machine guns.
So that was shortly after 11 o'clock when the grief ceremony was just over. It was that late when the police first time realized that there were 8 terrorists, not only 5 as they believed until then.
After this Gedenkfeier, we went back. We were then protected by hundreds of soldiers, you know, the ones that survived. There were a few Israelis who survived because they were in another apartment where the terrorists didn't come in. And myself, we were kept somewhere. And then they asked us, the other guys, they said, please go back to your apartments in the Connollystrasse and bring back the personal stuff of the ones that are killed, because they were all 2 in a room. And they said, you know their personal stuff, what belongs to this one and so on, and bring it back to us. So I said, okay, I will go and bring back Andre's stuff. Because I was there every day in his room. And they said, no, you cannot go there because that's where they murdered Josef Romano and the scene there is too much. I said, I'm going to pick up his stuff. So I took with me one of his fencers, you know, who was one of his students, you know, who was fencing at the Olympics. He had 2 students, Andre. He was the coach. So I took one of them with me. So we went back to the Connollystrasse. Everything was open. Nothing, there was no police or nothing, you know. So we went to the apartment and I opened the door and I could see from the entrance, in the middle of the apartment, there was this staircase, a round staircase. And I looked and the blood came down the staircase and on the floor. And so the fencer said to me, Anki, please do not go upstairs to his room. And I said, I have to go
and see where Andrei spent the last hours of his life. I have to go there. He didn't come with me, so I went up myself. And, you know, the scene that I saw there, that is engraved in my mind forever. Because you come into the room, you know, you have to jump over all the blood stuff. And then, you know, they shot him with a Kalashnikov 7 times. So there were big holes in the walls and, you know, the part of the wall came back into the room. They brought them food that nobody ate, so it was all on the floor. They didn't let them go to the bathroom. I stood there and I said to myself, how can people do this to each other? You know, how can people have so much hate in them that they can come and kill not the enemy on the battlefield, but people that come to the Olympic Games to be part of the festival of brotherhood and peace and goodwill, and then do this, you know? I was 26, just a young person, but I couldn't believe it. And I said, if this is what happened to my very gentle husband, you know, I was only married 1 year and 3 months with him, and to the father of my baby, I will not shut up talking about it. Not out of revenge, but because if you don't talk about it, and if people forget, they're going to repeat it.
Strictly confidential. Police leading staff, Munich. Munich, September 6th, 1972.
This same day, September 6th, the leading staff around police president Schreiber and his deputy Wolf for debriefing. It results in a report for internal use. At this point, a personal comment. During my research, I reviewed countless summaries and reports. Some shorter, some longer, some very straight, others a bit unclear. Not surprising in such a situation. But this report doesn't read like a fact-based summary. This sounds to me like some kind of justification. Mistakes are denied. So let's get into.
Subject. Summary of the occurrences in connection with the hostage taking of Israeli athletes September 5th and 6th.
The command post have had two options only, it reads in the beginning. Rendering the perpetrators harms or accepting their demands.
This decision was clear from the beginning of rendering the perpetrators harms due these facts. First, the Israeli government decided from the beginning that the terrorists' demand would not be fulfilled. Second, IOC President Brundage demanded to prevent the kidnapping of actively in the Olympic Games participating athletes. Third, federal and state governments decided they had to protect their roles as hosts of the Games and therefore making the kidnapping of the hostages impossible.
The police then have had three tactical chances to stop the terrorists. Chance number one, raiding the house Connollystrasse 31 in the Olympic Village.
This opportunity was not taken because it would not have saved the life of the hostages. It would have caused even more fatalities amongst police officers and would have been dangerous for other athletes and civilians.
Chance number two, stopping the perpetrators next to the back door of the house on their way to the parking deck to the helicopters.
This opportunity, including appropriate measures, was prepared. It could not be realized because the perpetrators decided on short notice not to walk to the helicopters.
As we learned in the previous episode, they demanded a bus and got one. So when chance number one and chance number two were gone, only one last remained. Getting terrorists and hostages to Fürstenfeldbruck Airfield and take action there.
This place was chosen for its tactical advantages for the police. There was no danger for people from the outside. And it was good to carefully plan how to position the sharpshooters.
Sounds good in theory, but didn't work in practice. Beginning with the basic fact that there were only 5 sharpshooters against 8 terrorists. 1 sharpshooter for each of the terrorists, so that if everything runs perfect, all terrorists could be stopped within 1 coordinated attack. This was the plan. We will now project how this turned in real life, and we will also discuss what sharpshooter meant in practice. But let's start with the idea of 1 sharpshooter for each of the terrorists and a coordinated attack. It starts when we look at what the sharpshooters knew about the terrorists, and even the number of terrorists. Hear now what sharpshooters testified later.
At this time I was informed that we should only shoot if it was possible to switch off at least 4 of the assumably 5 terrorists on shooting order.
I didn't hear that there were more than 5 terrorists.
Until I shot first time, but latest when they returned fire out of the first helicopter, I was convinced that they were 5 terrorists.
Then the carefully planning of the positioning. Problem here. The sharpshooters didn't know the exact landing position of the helicopters. Therefore, it was difficult for them to position themselves so that they could overlook the entire scene and find a good shooting position.
I was really confused about the fact that the helicopters were planned to land far more in the western part. Surprisingly, they landed straight in front of me. So when aiming against the helicopters, I was aiming against the tower as well. If I had known before where they really would be landing, I would have looked for another position for sure.
The helicopters didn't land where they were supposed to land, north of the tower and close to the runway. This created a totally new situation.
And even more, the sharpshooters didn't have walkie-talkies. They were simply not available in Fürstenfeldbruck. A word about the guns. 3 of the sharpshooters were given G3 guns with aiming scopes. 2 of them so-called FN guns with aiming scopes as well. None of them counts as a sniper gun. And finally, none of these so-called sharpshooters were trained as sharpshooters or snipers. 2 of them at least had been completed missions with distance shooting before. 3 of these officers are normal city policemen. 2 of them work for the state police. And one more thing. 2 of them have worked for more than 16 hours when the shooting in Fürstenfeldbruck started, and 1 over 14 hours. And finally, they simply ignore that they were informed about the number of terrorists at an early stage. There were these 3 employees of the German Postal Service who saw them climbing over the fence when they intruded the Olympic Village. These 3 witnesses who presented themselves immediately have been interrogated only at 6 o'clock in the evening, the information not handed over and still ignored by the police command the day after. The postman said that there were at least 8 terrorists. Back to the report of the Munich Police Command.
File notice. A Lufthansa jet plane were flown in and parked. There was no crew available.
Another problem that emerged only at last minute. Did the German authorities want to let the terrorists believe they seriously would allow them to fly out, but no flight crew to be seen? Of course not. This was the moment when they created the idea to dress the 14 police officers in colorful overalls. And then the paper does not mention one crucial fact, that these 14 officers went off before the helicopters landed. Instead, it describes the moment when the shooting began, when Issa and Tony finished inspecting the plane and returned to the helicopters.
The shooters were instructed to switch off the 2 terrorists who went back to the helicopters and, at the same moment, the 2 who were standing next to the helicopters. While the last mentioned were put out of action immediately, this did not succeed with their other 2. Both of them fired back with their machine guns and tried to get to the helicopters to hide away. One of them was hit on his way. The other found shelter underneath a helicopter. After this first gunfight, it was silent for a moment. The terrorists ignored the request on loudspeaker to give up.
On the contrary, the police command describes the next scene as if the terrorists took control.
In the following, each of our initiation was foiled to their shooting with their machine guns. Unfortunately, one of our officer has been killed then. From the inside of the helicopters, shooting could be heard. This could lead to the assumption that there were more terrorists in the helicopters who were unknown until then, who now executed the hostages.
And then the final verdict, self-verdict.
The reproach of lack of security measures in the Olympic Village not applicable.
No reproach applicable. Well, this was the official position created within the Munich Police Command on September 6, 1972, just hours after the disaster and the bloodshed. And what about these three terrorists whom the brave police officer Heinz G. had picked from the ground when inspecting the apron right after the shootout? Well, one of his colleagues joined him. They escorted them into the tower and took away their clothes.
Munich, September 6, 1972. Subject: murder after hostage taking in the Olympic Village and on the airfield Fürstenfeldbruck. Here, transportation of three arrested terrorists into the prison Munich Stadelheim.
One of the officers writes a report about how he met the terrorists inside the Fürstenfeldbruck Tower building.
The terrorists were undressed. Two of them were injured, one at his foot, the other at his hand. They lay on stretchers. The third was not injured and lay on his stomach on the floor. His hands were tied at his back.
The officers tried to approach them and to find their names.
We spoke to them in German and English, but no success. Under the given circumstances, they had to be transferred into a prison.
Then each of them was driven in a separate car to the prison, each of them escorted and guarded by three policemen. Then all three start speaking. And they are receiving a very prominent visitor, a former justice minister from Algeria, flown in from Algeria to Munich just for them. One of these three is writing Kasiba and a secret diary. I was able to review it. And they say they would be freed soon, as if they knew what would happen next.
Geheimakte 1972, 50 Jahre nach dem Olympia-Attentat in München. Ein Podcast der Antenne Bayern Group.
You like this podcast? Consider writing a review, sharing it with your friends or clicking like or full 5 stars. You feel you have something to contribute? Contact me via email to geheimakte@antenne.de.